Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Okay, it's time for questions and answers. So again, if I can ask people, if you have a question, if you could wait for the microphone before speaking and give your name and organisation before doing so, and stand also as well, please. As well, this is your opportunity, online viewers, to submit a question to chair. Use that button on your screen. So, are there any questions, please, from the floor? Have we received anything online at the moment? Oh, there is a question from Stephen, please. Thank you.
Can I ask you about top-ups and foundation degrees? If you do a BSc Honours, no automatic top-up, why can we not accept foundation degrees having a similar right as a qualification in its own right, and we have to always assume it's got a top-up, where you don't, it could exist as its own qualification in its own right?
Yeah, I think that's the position, if I may.
Yes, please, John.
That's the position that we're moving towards. I go back, you know, not very far, to the HN. Lots of people with an HND didn't see the need to top that up to a full D or anything else. That was sufficient for their needs, for the level of employment they wanted, sufficient for their employer as well. And that still is the case across the piece. So I think it's right, and I don't think necessarily that the top-up has to be to an honours degree. And certainly for a lot of students, it's going to be into the various professional bodies that we have that actually drive their occupations rather than any academic qualification. And that applies across a whole range of professional bodies. One of the things I think that's been lost in the debate about social mobility is at a local level, the value of what you might call the intermediate, you used to call the junior professional bodies, things like environmental health officers. I'm going to be grossly insulting to them now, of course, because it's not. But, you know, that's what makes the local economy tick in many cases, certainly made the public sector economy tick. And I think we've ignored that largely. And we've been too focused on the high-end professions of, you know, barristers, accountants, doctors, at the expense of recognising and valuing those skills that actually keep our local communities going. And I think the foundation degree has got a key role to play in that.
Sarah, is that something you'd wish you concur?
Yeah, no, I sort of agree with that. But from a student's perspective, the foundation degree, if it takes you to a job, is fine. But if there is the opportunity of a top-up or there's an opportunity of a progression, some of our students go away 2-3 years, go and do different jobs, then want to come back. They might have gone into a particular area and maybe want to come back and do teaching. But to do teaching at a higher level, or secondary, primary, they have to have the degree. And I think having the option of the top-up, I'm not saying that it has to be the be-all and end-all, but having that option there when somebody's paid £12,000 for a qualification to say, well, actually, that's the end of it, you've got nowhere to go, I don't think is fair. I take the point that I think they need to be more of qualifications in their own right, and maybe we shouldn't be driven so much by the progression that the universities set, but that's why where we've developed ours, they're fairly generic and broad. They're much more work-focused top-up degrees, and they are sort of like fully academic. Well, they're academic, but they are more vocational basis. So they sort of like have an opportunity, but they don't have to do it. So I think that the opportunity should always be there. I think one of the things that I would say is back in 2000, I was involved in the pilot foundation degrees with Plymouth University and Bournemouth when they first did them. And I did a review of the original foundation degrees when they were piloted. And one of the main differences between foundation degrees and HNDs at that time, and it was one of the reasons foundation degrees came in, was HNDs could all be at level one, HE or HE level four as it is now. Foundation degrees have pushed that so that you've got the level four and level five. So they almost built in progression. So that was one of the main drivers. And you know, although people might have been happy to do an HND, and a lot of our students take the foundation degree and stick with it, but the opportunity should be there, should they want it, to progress.
Steve?
So, yeah, I want to echo the sort of distinction between the opportunity and the requirement. I think there should be a requirement on HE, though, to make sure there is the opportunity. I think that would be the way I would think about it, not the expectation on the learner that they must accept it. And I think that probably if it is not the majority, it would be a large minority of students completing foundation degrees don't progress, at least immediately, to honours degrees, although obviously those of us who would like to welcome them take an interest in the numbers that, that do. So I think that we can have that both ways. But I think we ought also, to take John's point in particular, widen the scope of what we seek to articulate in terms of the curriculum, because I don't think it does have to be just honours degrees. It's progression I'm interested in, rather than kind of stasis within a particular qualification form.
Okay, thank you. Yes, please, John.
John Roger, it's the obvious question, Sarah, really. Are you going to apply for foundation degree awarding powers?
That's really interesting, because we don't have enough of our own direct numbers. Until there's a point where we can actually get all of our own numbers, we wouldn't have enough students that are directly funded to be able to do it. I'd love to be able to do it, because I think that it would strengthen what we offer. But I don't think that where we are at the moment, that's why we're so dependent upon our partnership, because we're dependent on the University of Plymouth for our numbers.
Okay, there's a question at the back and then one at the front here.
Richard Hewlett, Gloucestershire College. Do you think there's a tension between what HEIs are requiring as far as things like validation? They seem to be running scared of QAA. They do things very conservatively. The qualifications you've got to set up in a certain way. And things employers are asking us to do now, be much more flexible. The higher apprenticeships coming through, requiring bite-sized chunks, not the whole qualification done at once. Is there a tension there, and how would we overcome it?
Yes.
Yes. That's the answer to the first question.
There is, and I couldn't help, I think, when John was talking about the slow pace of processes to validation, of the criticisms to which some HEIs have been subjected for doing things too fast. So there is a sense of you can't win, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. What you have to do about it seems to me, is we have to continue to navigate those contradictions. I think we have to expect that the QAA will be conservative and the employers will demand that we're responsive. It seems to me to be unlikely that either of them would change in those ways. And we have to continue to stress, I think, the advantages of a more flexible approach. But I'd be very disappointed if HEIs were simply sort of characterised as stodgily conservative, although no doubt they sometimes can be, when in fact sometimes they're simply constrained by other expectations.
Okay, thank you. There's a question at the front here.
Richard Conder, member of Guernsey State Assembly in Education Department. Question for Sarah, if I might. In terms of remote communities such as Guernsey, Cornwall, Shetlands and so on, how realistic is it to develop very small numbers and sustain them within colleges of FE?
When you say small numbers, do you mean small cohorts?
Small cohorts, yeah.
I don't think it's going to be anymore. If you want my honest answer, I think we're all going to have to push our numbers from smaller cohorts up to possibly, I would think, a minimum 10, maybe 12 in groups. But, I mean, one of the ways that you can look at it is whether or not you can have some core modules that are shared. So if you've got, say, 40 credits out of 120 that they share, so you could put three small groups together and then your teaching becomes more viable. But no, it's something that we're looking at, because at the end of the day, I mean, we've got some small groups, but I don't know that going forward. The other thing is, at the moment, we're charging 6,000. Maybe if we put the price up, the small groups would remain viable. Don't know. It's an unknown, such an unknown future going forward. I can't answer your question. Sorry. I would love to say yes, but I think the long and short of it is it has to be cost effective.
John?
I just think a plug for collaboration, really, because the other aspect of that is the student experience within a small group, which can sometimes be, sometimes we think small groups are great, but actually for the student it can reduce the amount of interaction and exchange and development and so on. So I'm not a great lover of small groups. So I think if there is a college, and we shouldn't forget, after the core and margin exercise, there are now, is it 65 new HEFCE-funded institutions with a minimum of 25 students, which satisfies my criterion for a small HE community in a college. That has to be dealt with by those institutions. They have to ask themselves some very serious questions about, can we give an appropriate higher experience for those students. It won't be the same as university. And certainly working in the city where I work, you know, the experience that my students get is very different to that of another institution about a mile away. But they choose that. That's what they want. It's not that they're obliged to do it. So I think that, that there's a lot around working together, even using virtual means if you happen to choose to live where you live. With all its advantages, there is the disadvantage. But there are ways of communicating. I think just a final plug for foundation degree awarding powers, because what it's allowed us to do is to tackle some of the issues that Sarah's just mentioned. So we've now got cross-validation modules, if you like, across different disciplines, which we found very difficult to achieve with our partner universities, partly because some of them happened to be in different faculties of the university, and the university rules didn't allow that sort of combination to take place. So you had, for example, something like leadership skills differently regarded by different faculties. We can now offer modules that are across a number of pathways that allow a great deal more economy of scale in delivery.
And there is another danger with that we could sort of like knock into, as it were, and that is that the progression to the university, because it's quite specific, they will say you can't change the modules. So in terms of having more generic final years, means you could actually have more generic FDs, more shared modules. So I think we're going into very uncertain times. I think we've come from slightly uncertain times in the last few years, but I think that, you know, the future, always been fairly good at seeing where I think our higher education is going. I have to say, this is like the first year that I can't put my hand on my heart and give you a really solid answer.
And there, I'm afraid I'm going to have to draw a line under that to give you a chance for a cup of coffee, which again will be served in room 118. Let me give you the details of the seminars, which are the next session after the coffee break. Seminar one, which is Jeff Booth talking about linking HE programmes to employers, that will be in room 116. Seminar two, Julie Hall on HE staff development, will be in room 104, otherwise known as the main hall. Thank you to all the viewers on the web for listening in. Thanks again to the supporters of this conference, Guild HE, the 157 Group, and Action on Access. Please don't forget your evaluation forms. And finally, lastly but not least, of course, please join me to thank again our speakers for this session, Steve, John and Sarah.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.